Hello, our name is Junk Food Cinema. You spoke ill of Battle Truck. Prepare to die.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Everybody, it's Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. .com. We're also on BlogTalkRadio.com.
.com.
That's twice in one episode we've pulled that joke, but we're not above it. Of course we're not above
it. We're not below it. We'll take it. Whatever.
We're right in the middle. Guys, if you would like to hear more of this middling podcast, we are on Blog Talk Radio, as we mentioned, our entire back catalog. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show, if your wish is to see this show continue,
as you wish,
Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema is a great way to support us, keep the lights on, keep the stories being read. You know, sometimes when little Fred Savage, which is our podcast, is sick, we have to hire Peter Falk to come in and read fairy tales to us. So that's not cheap. That guy's dead. So it costs us a lot of money.
That requires expensive necromantic magics to happen.
Yes, necromancy don't come cheap. So patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. I'm Brian. He is Cargill. He's Lieutenant Megaforce. He's a screenwriter. He is someone who has six fingers on his right hand.
That's not my hand, Brian.
Oh. Ooh, that's awkward. Oh, okay. We need to rethink this entire show. And we are kind of still in the summer of 1987. We're at the end of things.
We're wrapping up the summer of 87, and there's no way we could possibly talk about the summer of 87 without talking about perhaps one of the greatest movies to come out of 1987.
True story.
One of the most meme-worthy movies to come out of 87, a movie that has been perpetually in print, is constantly being shown at retrospective houses, is referenced daily by almost everyone you know. It is one of those movies, and it is, of course, The Princess Bride.
This is a special book. It was the book my father used to read to me when I was sick, and I used to read it to your father. And today, I'm going to read it to you.
I'll try and stay awake.
I never say anything about killing anyone.
I just happened to look behind us and something is there.
He's obviously seen us with the princess and let's therefore die. Pick up one of those rocks. Get behind the boulder. The minute his head is in view, hit it with the rock!
I've got my country's 500th anniversary to plan, my wedding to arrange, my wife to murder. I'm swapped.
Jesus, Grandpa, what did you read me this thing for?
Well, who says life is fair? Where is that written?
Fencing, fighting, chases, escapes, giants, monsters, torture, revenge, true love, miracles.
And what I love about us covering The Princess Bride, and, you know, cheating a little bit because it is, in fact, an October release of 1987. But if there's one thing that Junk Food Cinema completely endorses, it's the idea of a cheat day. I mean, I know you're probably on your diets and you're doing your P90Xs and you're doing your CrossFits. We are all about the cheat day at Junk Food Cinema because that's the day you go to Taco Bell and you stick a chalupa inside another chalupa and you go crazy. We love it. Absolutely love it. But what I love about us covering Princess Bride here at the end of all things, here at the end of this series, is that we have now covered two romance films back to back, something that I think is going to make a lot of our listeners go, what show am I even hearing anymore?
And on top of that, we're covering two Reiner films this summer.
Oh my God, you're right.
Oh yeah, we covered Daddy Reiner's film, Summer School, a couple months back, and now we're covering his son, Rob Reiner's film, which it's one of those things. Carl Reiner is a comedy legend, and Rob Reiner is a legendary director. And to have father and son put out movies in the same summer, have to love both of them, but to acknowledge that what is clearly heads and shoulders and Andre the Giant versus
Andre the Giant's head and shoulders above
the film. It's kind of like, yeah, that's wow, what a double a double whammy in that family. I wonder what Thanksgiving was like in that house. So
I can tell you one thing: there wasn't a lot of turkey left over the next day.
So, but yeah, of course, you know, this movie, if you don't love this movie, what are you doing here? Like, this is one of those, this is one of those rare movies where, you know, we don't like to judge people upon their movie taste, but this is one of those that if you ever met somebody who's like, you know what I really hate? I fucking hate The Princess Bride. You'd kind of question wanting to be in the same room with them. Like, what?
I kind of question whether that person is born of Earth. Or perhaps is a vindictive alien species? Because how in the world do you not love The Princess Bride? It is one of the most, I hate to use the word innocuous, but like, it is one of the most, it's one of the most beloved movies because there's nothing to dislike about it.
Yeah. It's an unrepentant work of genius. Like, it is, like, in its whole history, the way it came about, what it is, who made it, like, it is one of those films that it does something special that no one else has been able to pull off and no one could. Like, it was such its own thing that it's not a parody. It's not a satire. It is a special kind of comedy that does a lot of things at once and does it all spectacularly.
It is reverent about the idea of fairy tales, but told from the perspective of a young boy hearing a fairy tale who is jaded against them until he hears the entire story. So it's really a question of, it's really a story about not judging stories until you've heard the whole thing.
And
stepping outside of your own wheelhouse.
Thematically, it is the soul of our podcast. This is, you know, here you have this kid who starts out at the beginning of this movie, thinking this is silly, this is stupid, prejudging it, and then finally giving himself over, and then even the stuff that he normally doesn't like, he allows himself to like, because it's like, you know what, I love this warts and all. You know, yes. I don't like kissing books, but you know what, just this one time, you know what, I love everything else about this, so I'm loving this. Like, this is watching a young junkie on come into his own and accept, you know what, maybe it's okay to like this thing that beforehand I didn't think was okay to like.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of people have the misconception about this show that we don't like romance films, and I feel like that is part and parcel of what this movie is and what our show really is that we don't have a prescribed genre. We don't have something that is like dogma. We only like action movies. We only like horror movies. It's like, no, we like movies that are good.
In fact, we're discussing it right now. We might have three romances in a row.
Oh my God, you're right. Oh, we have the trifecta of romances coming up, folks.
Because you know what? This was a good summer for those.
It really was.
The ones that came out were really fucking good. So, but we'll see. We're still hammering that out.
But I noticed, and I noticed during the release of our Dirty Dancing episode that we had a number of people on social media telling us, you know, I don't normally like movies like this, but your episode really made me want to revisit it. And it's like, yes, guys.
Good.
This is what I'm talking about.
Never, ever say no to a Swayze movie.
Like, never put a Swayze movie in the corner. Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, even the bad Swayze movies are worth checking out.
What's a bad Swayze movie?
One of the Summer of 87 movies we chose not to watch, Steel Dawn.
Wait, you said a bad Swayze movie, though.
Yeah, Steel Dawn. It's a post-apocalyptic movie starring Patrick Swayze that I didn't want to talk about this summer. How bad does that have to be?
It's a red flag.
I will say for those of you out there that you're up at midnight, you've had a couple of beers, it's worth, there's enough to it making it worth watching, just not enough worth doing an hour-long episode.
It turns out the amount of alcohol we would have to recommend that you ingest to enjoy a movie like Steel Dawn goes past the point of responsible podcasting.
I will also say it's not bad enough that it's going to show up in our worst of.
Oh, God, no.
Like, it doesn't even touch that.
But that's more of an indictment of 1987 than it is an indictment of Steel Dawn.
That is also correct.
Because so, there were just more movies that were worse.
Yeah, it's like, wait, so for those of you doing the mental math, you know, having that algebra scene in front of your eyes right now, it is a movie that is clearly worse than American Ninja 2 and Masters of the Universe, but better than Jaws the Revenge and Superman 4 Quest for Peace.
Do so that math. That Do is that math,
where
guys.
That is the sweet spot where you'll find Steel Dawn. Star-Lord! But we're not talking about Steel Dawn.
We're not, we're as it turns about, out, talking about Steel Dawn.
We're talking
today.
About The Princess Fucking Bride.
The Princess Bride, which, by the way, we need to talk about before we even dive into the cast of this movie. I mean, you mentioned Rob Reiner already, but we need to talk about a person named William Goldman.
Oh, yes. Well, that was, yeah, that beyond the pale. I mean, this is the most important thing about why this movie works.
If you have heard of a movie in the 70s, that is legendary. You have a 1 in 3 shot that William Goldman is responsible for the script.
He is considered in the screenwriting circles the greatest screenwriter of all time. Like, he is the guy that he's the go-to guy. He's the hero of screenwriting. He is our hero. He is our champion. Let's just run down a few of the touchstones on that path.
Let's go full Sean William Scott and just run down this shit.
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Ding!
The Stepford Wives.
Ding!
The Great Waldo Pepper.
Ding, ding, ding!
All the President's Men.
Ding, 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 ding!
Marathon Man.
Are you kidding me, folks?
A Bridge Too Far.
Oof.
We're not even out of the 70s yet. A movie called Heat, which we will probably cover at some point, which was remade a few years ago. Literally, they just used the same script and made a Jason Statham film out of it called Wild Card, which is worth watching because that script is so fucking good.
That's funny because I remember seeing Wild Card and thinking, wow, I know this is a direct-to-video Statham movie, and those are innumerable, but this is actually pretty cool.
Because they literally took this great 1986 movie, because he wrote the novel of Heat and then wrote the screenplay. And it's a 1986 Burt Reynolds movie.
Done.
Who are you going to replace Burt Reynolds with? Jason Statham? All right. He also
if you listen very closely, you'll hear the sound of us not complaining about that.
He also wrote Misery. Yep. Chaplin.
Yep.
Maverick.
Oh, my God, Maverick. I saw that 2 days ago.
How great was fucking Maverick?
I love Maverick.
Like, I referenced
Maverick.
That to you a few weeks ago, and you were like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And
No. You said, we were in the middle of an episode, and you said, the actor, who's Maverick? It wasn't the movie. You said, the actor, who's Maverick? And I immediately said, Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
I know. I love that movie. I've seen that. Yeah. I revisited that movie 2 days ago, and just, I was like delighted at how great it holds up.
Yep. And however, we also would be remiss not to mention that he's also written some truly, truly, truly terrible movies as well.
Name two.
Dreamcatcher.
Damn.
And Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
You don't have to name another one after Dreamcatcher.
Yeah, he's part of the adaptation mess of what happened with Dreamcatcher.
This is why the other day when somebody asked us on our Patreon mailbag, what is the worst movie made by the best collection of people? The answer is Dreamcatcher.
Like, you've got one of the greatest screenwriters turned directors of all time. You've got one of the greatest screenwriters of all time. You've got one of the greatest novelists of all time. You've got such a great cast. And it's so awful that William Goss plays it for his birthday every once in a while.
It's so bad that it feels like a tax dodge. Like, the whole movie just feels like an excuse to hide money, to squirrel money away so the government can't get their hands on it. That's how bad that movie is. But it does not detract from the fact that William Goldman is one of the greatest screenwriters of all time.
I don't think Dreamcatcher or Memoirs of an Invisible Man are his fault at all. But we can't talk about how, hey, by the way, he wrote some of the greatest movies ever made without mentioning, yeah, he also wrote one.
We don't want to be revisionist. Yeah. We don't want to be revisionist in our approach to William Goldman.
So what William Goldman did was, in 1973, he published The Princess Bride. And what he did was, it was presented as if he was writing an abridged version of a classical Renaissance story written by somebody else. Like, it was, the whole thing was a goof in its own way. Like, it was a lark on what was happening in publishing at the time and doing abridged versions of these lengthy classic epics. And so he's presenting this story as if it is, you know, as if it is an adaptation of this fiction book, but the adaptation itself is fiction. So it's presented as that, and it was something that connected with people. Like, that book just did, you know, he would constantly, he's talked about it, he would get letters about it constantly. Like, people just connected with this book. And finally, it was decided to go ahead and turn it into a movie. Well, how do you turn that into a movie? Well, that's where he created the wraparound story with Peter Falk and Fred Savage, and ended up creating, like, it's hard to say it, but I honestly think this is William Goldman's greatest achievement. Like, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is phenomenal. And
it's hard to argue that, you know, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is anything but masterful.
Yeah. And then Marathon Man is just amazing. All the President's Men is one of those unbelievably incredible fucking movies, a movie that's been referenced a lot over the last 6 months. You know, there's so many of his things, but really, I feel like Princess Bride is his masterpiece.
I would agree with that. And it actually reminds me a lot of another classic movie from the 80s, The Neverending Story, because both of those movies are about the contemporary reaction, the contemporary context for a very classic fantasy story, for a very classic fairy tale. And I love the way that Goldman plays with narrative in The Princess Bride, because this movie doesn't open on some epic sword fight. It doesn't open on castles. It doesn't open on giants. It doesn't open on princesses. It opens on a game of bases loaded on the NES. So immediately my nerd boner is fully up. Are you kidding me? Like, literally the first shot of this movie is an 8-bit version.
Is he playing it on the NES? I always thought he was playing it on a Commodore 64.
Oh, no, it's an NES. It is definitely an NES. And it's and like the 8-bit version of that. And then enter the room one of my favorite actors of all goddamn time, Peter Falk, in one of the roles that, like, I feel like in the pantheon of roles for Peter Falk, there is Columbo, and then there is the grandfather from Princess Bride. Like, immediately right there under Columbo. And we see him coming to his sick grandson's room and saying, you know, I know you're sick. I thought maybe I would read you this story. And then you have that sort of, like, generational divide where Fred Savage is just like, I don't want, it's not really. But he also is not a total asshat, so he's like, yeah, sure, Grandpa, I'll humor you. So Peter Falk sits down and reads him this story of the Princess Bride, and throughout the movie, you have this very meta construct where every once in a while you have Fred Savage interrupting the telling of the story, which interrupts the movie itself.
Yes, it really is, and it does allow it. Also, the thing about it is, it's such a brilliant cheat. Like, it is such a great way, you know, that the toughest part in telling a story is figuring out how to leave a room, how to enter a room and how to leave a room is how they call it. Like, how do you bring a character in and how do you get them to leave in a way that the audience doesn't stop thinking about, you know, wait, that was abrupt. And this allows him to jump around in the story exactly the way he needs to get through boring parts, to get through how do they get from here to here. Literally, by just having the scene get interrupted, having this conversation, this meta conversation, and then being able to just jump back in exactly to the moment of the story that you need to be at. And it does a really great way of breaking a lot of things up and making the pacing work really well. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a brilliant structure idea that it's fascinating to look at when you even just look at it from a structural perspective, like just breaking it down, like, oh wow, when they pull out of that moment, it's so perfect. It's masterful. Like, I'm in awe of how this movie's put together. Like, I love this movie as what it has become. It's literally my wife's one of her favorite movies. We've seen it so many times. I love what it is on that sense. But when you break it down and just look at how it was put together, there's nothing slapdash about this movie. It is so perfectly constructed in every way.
And I think a great testament to this movie is that usually you and I watch these movies again right before we record. We didn't need to with this film because we've seen it so many times that literally it's encoded into our fucking DNA.
Yeah.
Like really I think you're right. I think it's become very meme worthy. A lot of people can quote it. I think a lot of people that can quote this movie, you can quote it before you've ever even seen it, which is a real testament to the pop culture legacy of a movie, is when you can really get into the minutiae of a film before you've even fucking seen a frame of it.
The only film I can think of that rivals this one in terms of how many memes were generated by it is Casablanca.
Oh, interesting.
Like where you think about, you know.
See, I thought you were going to say Star Wars.
No. Star Wars is, it's like the meme culture around Star Wars. Like Star Wars is definitely up there. I would definitely argue that Star Wars is in there as well. And the Star Wars trilogy itself, like, you know, the biggest meme to come out of that is Luke, I'm your father. But like with Casablanca, like so many of the little dialogue bits have become, you know, the problems of two people don't amount to a hill of beans in this world.
Sure.
Of
the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Of all the gin joints, you walked into mine. Play it again, Sam, which isn't actually said, but is a meme that, you know, people assume is in sure. that movie. You've got... just so many of the various things that come out of Casablanca. Or my favorite, I'm shocked to find there's gambling in this establishment.
Oh, yes, of course.
But this one, like, this has so many. You've got, you know...
Hello. My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
You've got As You Wish.
Oh, As You Wish.
As You Wish.
You've got The Six-Fingered Man. You've got The Rodents of Unusual Size.
Yeah, well, I mean, hell, you've got everything that Wallace Shawn said. Oh, Inconceivable.
Inconceivable.
For fuck's sake, Inconceivable.
You keep using that word.
I don't think it means what you think it means.
I think I said that to you the last time we recorded about a completely separate issue before we knew this was going to be the next episode.
Yeah, this is, you know, there's so much that just comes out of this movie. And that's before you get to the subtle ones where you're just referencing the movie. Like, Inconceivable, like, it's... All you have to do is go Inconceivable at everybody there. Yeah.
No one's going to be like, what's that from?
Yeah.
Inconceivable.
No, they get it. They totally get it. And I think it's also worthwhile to mention the fact that we've kind of been touching on it, but we talk about movies that are sort of junk food buffets, just the embarrassment of riches of cast members and talent behind it and how they're all sort of in the universe of junk food cinema. Yeah, we mentioned Wallace Shawn. We've mentioned Mandy Patinkin. Of course, the two stars of this movie are Carrie. Okay, here's something I need to put straight immediately. When I was growing up, I always thought his last name was pronounced Yules, but no, I think it's Elwes.
It is,
right?
Elwes.
Okay, so there's Elwes, and then there's, of course, Robin Wright Penn, who, by the way, just fucking like brought Buttercup full circle with that Wonder Woman movie.
Oh, God, yes, where she went from being the princess needing saving up to being the badass fucking general.
She went from being the damsel.
30 years later,
yeah.
and looks maybe 2 days older.
It's ridiculous.
The genetics on her are insane.
She is the princess of unusual youth. I don't understand how that's possible. But yeah, she went from being the damsel to being the, like, I will kill anyone, and I am the greatest warrior of all time. That was one of my favorite parts of watching Wonder Woman, is just seeing her in battle.
Can I also mention, just going back a little bit, I love that Wallace Shawn in this movie makes Princess Bride the gateway drug to My Dinner with Andre. Like, there's so many people have watched.
Wait, is it My Dinner with Andre the Giant? Because I want to see that movie immediately.
Why did Wallace Shawn not make that movie?
Why did Wallace Shawn at least not make that parody film, My Dinner with Andre the Giant? Come on, Wallace.
Inconceivable.
Yeah, no, but yeah, it's like there are so many people who have watched My Dinner with Andre because they're like, oh, I love him in Princess Bride. And then like, what the fuck is this? And it's like, it's the art film of the 80s, asshole. Welcome to Wallace Shawn's universe. So, yeah, but I just love that the Princess Bride has been that gateway drug. So, yeah, no, but that, so we just mentioned him. Andre the fucking Giant is in this movie.
Anybody want a peanut?
And is fucking great in it.
This is okay. So speaking of the world, the universe of junk food cinema, this film, this script, this project had been in the works for almost a decade before it actually got made. They were first throwing it around 1974, and at that time, And then as they were moving forward into the 80s, the person they wanted to play Fezzik was Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Arnold Schwarzenegger was all about it. He thought it'd be a great project. And by the time they actually got it made in 1987, the thing you need to realize is that William Goldman never wanted Arnold Schwarzenegger. He always wanted Andre the Giant to play this character. And the studio was pushing for Schwarzenegger. By the time this movie got made in 1987, you might have noticed that we've talked about two Schwarzenegger movies already in just this series alone. He was such a big star that they couldn't afford him anymore.
No.
So Goldman got his wish by de facto, because it was like, we can't afford Schwarzenegger, so I guess we'll do Andre the Giant, as you've always wanted.
As you wish.
It hurts me that he died when he did, because I would have loved to have seen Andre the Giant in more comedies, because he's fucking great in this movie.
He is. He really is. And and everybody who worked with him talked about how amazing he was.
He called everybody boss on set. Doesn't matter if you were a key grip, you know, somebody in lighting, the DP. He called everybody boss because he had such a respect for the art of filmmaking.
Yeah, he was something else. Dude, he also, I think he holds the still holds the world record for most beers drank in a sitting. Like, I think he drank 126 cans of beer.
As much as you and I try to beat that record from recording to recording, I think you're right. I think he still holds that.
Yeah, no, dude, we couldn't do that together, for fuck's sake, no. Like, that's
not
just,
for lack of trying,
that's
but you're
one
right.
Sitting. That's one fucking sitting. It's insanity. Of course, the rest of the cast, oh my God. We've got Mel Smith as the albino.
Yep.
We've got Carol Kane and Billy Crystal playing.
As Miracle Max and his wife.
Yeah, and in another, you know, have fun storming the castle, another fucking meme from this. This.
Do you think they have a chance?
It would take a miracle.
Is there a difference between all dead and mostly dead? Because I feel like there's a difference between those two things, thanks to Miracle Max.
To blave.
He said to blave, which of course means to lie, bluff. To bluff. Oh my God. Thank you, Miracle Max. I just figured out what this junk food pairing is going to be.
Okay, great. a nice MLT.
Yes!
Mutton, lettuce, and tomato where the mutton is nice and lean.
Man, yeah, we're showing our hand too early, but yes, that's probably what
by the way, we'll talk about it. I actually make mutton, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches that you can actually buy roast mutton at Central Market.
Okay, so I must reveal my ignorance. What is mutton again? It's a horse?
No, it's lamb.
Oh, it's lamb. Okay, good. That makes a lot more sense.
So we've got the villains are played by the two Chrises.
Yes.
Two Chrises who in their own right are amazing. Chris Sarandon, who we have talked about in the past.
Fright Night.
Yeah, as the villain in Fright Night. And then Christopher Guest, who of course is a legendary comedian
What a crazy role for him to play.
Oh, yeah.
When you think about his career, what a fucking bug nuts role for him. He's the enforcer of the evil prince. And this is the guy who fucking directed all of the crazy mockumentaries, like
the
Best
improv
in Show.
Mockumentaries.
Yes,
yeah.
Like what the fuck are you doing playing like Hand of the Evil King in this?
Who's an Oscar winner, I believe, for best song, like for Mighty Wind.
I think you're right, actually.
It's so crazy. And this movie made so many careers. Cary Elwes got a career out of this. Robin Wright Penn blew up after this. Of course, Mandy Patinkin. Who's a phenomenal actor. Who's probably, I would argue, the best actor in this film in terms of just sheer range and pathos. That just a phenomenal fucking actor. Has been working his entire
career. I don't know, I feel like he's more of a D'Artagnan
than
a pathos, but that's just me. With his sword fighting abilities. Really?
They can't hear the daggers that I'm staring
really?
At.
Really? Come on. I thought
how
that was pretty good.
His name is Porthos, asshole. Porthos the pirate.
By the way, one thing I learned in my research for this movie is the Dread Pirate Roberts, who comes up multiple times during the course of this movie, who is a big plot point, is based on a real pirate.
Yes.
There is a real pirate who was considered by many to be the most successful pirate of all time. And the Dread Pirate Roberts is actually based on him, which I did not know. So that was a little the more you know moment for me as we were researching this movie.
So yes, so this movie has an incredible cast.
For sure.
Everybody fucking nails. There's not a weak link in this movie.
Not even Fred Savage.
No, no. Well, I mean, he's kind of confined to the bed the whole time.
But still, he may be weak because of the illness, but he's not the weak link in this movie.
No. No, there just isn't one. Like, everybody takes their scenes and they run with it. Oh, God, another Mailwidge. Mailwidge is what wings us together.
Oh, the impressive clergyman.
Yes. Like this, God, this movie is made of memes. I feel like Dave Bowman.
It's made of memes.
It's full of memes. Yeah, this just everything, every moment about this film is so good that it has been sewn into the fabric of pop culture.
Yes.
In fact, it feels very weird doing an episode on a movie like this, because when we first set out, it's like, well, we'll never do a movie like this because everybody's fucking seen it. And yet we kind of just want to sit around and fucking talk about it.
Yeah, and because, like, even when you get down to the stunt work on this movie, somebody like Peter Diamond and Bob Anderson, who trained Cary Elwes and Manny Patinkin for that amazing sword fight sequence in this movie, these are guys who trained... Oh, I don't know. You know, people on Bond films, Lord of the Rings, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Star Wars, Errol Flynn and Burt Lancaster learned from them. Are you kidding me? They do not get enough due for how amazing the sword work is in this film. In fact,
I'm not left-handed.
I know something you do not. I am not left-handed. I took a stage combat class in college, and part of our final was, here are all the moves you have to do, but you have to come up with a narrative. And for our rapier fight, we just did the scene from Princess Bride between the Dread Pirate Roberts and Inigo Montoya, because, oh my God, like, that fight is so good. And yet at the same time, there's a quippiness, the back and forth, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing to watch. And even in now, when you've seen movies where, you know, buildings have to come down and moss for an action sequence to be considered an action, like half a city has to be leveled. One of the best action sequences I still think I've ever seen is the sword fight between Inigo Montoya and the Dread Pirate Roberts. It's so fucking good. And it's not surprising at all that the guys behind that are behind some of the greatest action movies of all time.
And but on top of that, you have that super clever writing right over all of that. Like, all of these, because you talk about that scene, then there's also the fun scene of watching Cary Elwes wrestle with one of the most unbeatable wrestlers of all time.
I mean, the only person who's ever body slammed Hulk Hogan, for God's sake.
Well, and that's, and to do a little sidebar here, one of the things about Andre the Giant was, like, as you all know, wrestling is predetermined.
What?
It's not fake. It's predetermined.
How dare you? No, it's true. Sheathe your tweets.
It is, but you would have situations, rare situations, especially in the early days of the WWF, when things were not as carefully manicured and controlled as they are now. And there were a lot of people during WrestleMania 3 who were afraid of what might happen if Andre the Giant decided not to give the match over to Hulk Hogan.
Oh, wow.
And that because nobody could physically beat Andre the Giant. It was just impossible. He was too big, he was too strong, and he was too heavy. You could not do the damage to him necessary in a wrestling match when it wasn't predetermined. And so there was a lot of concern as this is live television going out to millions of homes. What happens if he goes off narrative?
Yeah.
And of course, he was Andre the Giant. He was a consummate professional and fucking delivered one of the greatest matches of the fucking 80s.
Yeah, I realized I was backwards. Again, sheathe your tweets. It wasn't him that body slammed Hogan. It was Hogan that body slammed Andre the Giant. The only person, Andre the Giant was like, what, 600 pounds? Like, he was enormous guy.
He was gargantuan. Like, he's just gargantuan. Like, it's, and so gargantuan that to this day, the internet loves every once in a while going, hey, by the way, have you ever seen this picture of Andre the Giant standing next to normal sized people? How weird is that? And people are like, fuck yes, let us retweet that and upvote it and do all of our social media things because, yes, this is awesome.
You retweet it too, and you call it Mega Force Perspective.
Well, you know.
The daggers. Again, the daggers. There are people assassinated in this movie with smaller daggers than the ones you just shot at me with your eyes. That's all
you
I'm saying.
Do not mock Megaforce in this house. You do not throw shade
on Megaforce.
Not in this dojo. But it's he was so massive and he was so unbeatable, and that watching that battle in The Princess Bride again, that's not fucking Hulk Hogan. That's Cary Elwes. I've met Cary Elwes. He's a normal sized dude.
Yeah.
He's not a big guy. And you got that guy against fucking Andre the Giant, and that fight really works.
I remember even as a younger person than I am now, seeing him in movies like Liar Liar and then the first Saw and being like, you're the Dread Pirate Roberts. Like, something about this feels off.
Or The Crush.
Oh my God.
back at this, you know, I'm curious if we're ever going to get to the era or ever do a month where we're like, we're going to take the most innocuous people known to man, and we're going to create a really gross, scary thriller out of it. Like, there was this 3-year period in Hollywood where it's just like, okay, well, you know, The Hand That Rocked the Cradle did so well. What else could we make scary? And eventually it gets to the point, like, how about that high school girl across the street that has a crush on you? How about the paper boy? Like, literally, they get to those are movies that exist. Those are movies that played in theaters.
Here's what I'm going to say. The Hand That Rocks the Cradle is such, like you said, such an innocuous movie that the hero of that film is the Ghostbuster you always forget about.
That is true.
That is that fucking movie. But I will say we are going to cover those because we've talked at length about how in the 90s we were obsessed with Obsession.
Yeah.
We loved movies like Single White Female and Fatal Attraction and Basic Instinct and The Crush and Fear and all these movies that were just about people obsessed with other people. Yeah. So we're going to have an Obsession month sure.
That might have to happen.
Take a drink.
It was very hard for him to get away from that. In fact, the one movie he did that really kind of got him away from that was another satire where he did Mel Brooks' Men in Tights.
Oh, yes.
Where I'm the greatest Robin Hood.
Why?
Because unlike other Robin Hoods, I have an English accent.
Oh, my God.
And
so good.
A moment so good they used it in the trailer as the big fuck you, Kevin Costner.
because he looks directly at the camera when he says it.
That movie sadly does not hold up as well as some of the others. But we talked about that in the Spaceballs episode. He's somebody who's always really good. But yeah, it is such an iconic role that it is very hard to get away from seeing him as Wesley. And a lot of the actors in this movie, like Manny Patinkin, has that problem. Wallace Shawn has that problem. Like, these roles were so good and so career defining that we see them in those roles every time they show up. Like, every time you see Manny Patinkin, you're like, his hair's wrong.
I can't watch Criminal Minds. Hey, I'm the guy who can't watch Criminal Minds because I'm like, that's not Inigo Montoya. I can't do it.
His hair's all wrong.
His hair's all wrong, and it's 30 years later. Maybe I should get over it. Nope, not an Inigo Montoya.
Because these roles are so profound and so well done. Like, this whole movie's fucking magical.
Well, and I think this is one of the great things about The Princess Bride as a romance is how it functions so well to work for everyone because, yes, it's a romance, and it's one of the greatest romances of all time. But, you know, we've talked about the swordplay being so good. We haven't mentioned the fact that the Dread Pirate Roberts' costume is modeled after Zorro. So, I mean, you have action film lovers and swashbuckling film lovers from all generations kind of coming together to appreciate things about this movie, which I think is why the framing device is a grandfather, played by Peter Falk, reading this story to Fred Savage, the younger generation. Because that's exactly what this movie is. So it's really coming at you with two different classical storytelling ideas, one from literature and one from cinema. And that's fucking, and I think you're right, it's fucking genius the way Goldman puts this together.
Yeah, and also we, in what little screen time there is for certain characters, everybody is, in true fashion, everyone is given a desire,
mm-hmm.
and everybody gets their happy ending.
Yeah.
Like, literally, Fezzik just wants to be one of the good guys, and he wants to do something right for once. And he gets that at the end.
Oh, Fezzik has that, like, that Mitchell and Webb look moment where he's like, wait, are we the bad guys?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. And then he just wants to do something right. And so at the end of the movie, he finally did something right. I found these horses. And, you know, you've got Inigo Montoya, who finally gets his revenge and then finds out that that's empty and hollow. And it's like, have you considered piracy? And he gets his out because, you know, he goes on to become the man
the
in black,
the new Roberts. Dread
Pirate Roberts. Yeah. It's great. And of course, you know, Buttercup and Wesley get their happy ending. And then Fred Savage gets his happy ending, having spent this wonderful afternoon with his grandfather, and his grandfather has earned the respect of his grandson.
And he's learned not to conform to gender norms to the point that he can't even hear a kissing scene. Like, that's a really big moment for him.
Yeah, and this movie so expertly gives us these motivations of every character in the fucking movie, and then delivers a happy ending for every single one of them, and wraps it up nicely and neatly in a bow without forcing it. Like, it all comes together seemingly naturally, as if that's the way it was intended. And that is, there is an unbelievable brilliance in that. Like, it is so perfectly executed in that way. And it's a movie I marvel at. It's one of those movies that I consider, like, it's one of those greatest movies ever made that I never recommend to young screenwriters, because it's a movie that you can only duplicate. You can't, like, break down and go, this is why this works, and this is a formula I can use to make another film. No, it is its own formula. It's like The Godfather. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it is not a movie where you can just take the formula and insert other things to it and get a great film out of it. It is a thing that is its own beast that figured out how to be something wholly original, but wholly original in a way that you cannot duplicate without it being a blatant ripoff. Like, it is just, it's not like Jaws, where it's like, well, let's take the monster and put it in space, and now you have Alien, and oh, well, let's take the monster from Alien, we'll put it in an Arctic research facility, like, and have these movies be like, okay, these are their own things. No, you cannot adapt the formula of Princess Bride and have it be anything other than the Princess Bride.
No, you can't take the Princess Bride and make it with a giant bear and then you get, like, prophecy. Like, that's not really how it works, in fact. But
giant mutant bear with Armand DeSante as a Native American.
See, what
that
was,
is, like, if you're going to bring up prophecy,
which I did,
you gotta turn into that skid.
Well, the
prophecy is a special kind of
the fun part of that is like, I realized as I was saying that it could be prophecy. Or it could be Grizzly, because both of those movies are just Jaws with a bear.
They are.
And I want to go back for a second to the brilliance of this writing by talking about one of probably the most memed scenes, meme on the scene, of this film, which is, of course, the scene with Wallace Shawn and the cups.
Oh, yes.
The Iocane powder scene, which is just watching those two guys spar, and like that is on equal footing with the sword fight with Inigo Montoya, despite the fact that they never draw a blade between the two of them. It's just Wallace Shawn. That's his My Dinner with Andre moment right there.
Yeah.
It's just about the conversation.
Yes, it really is. And I can't help but think that might be what it is, where they got the idea for Wallace Shawn in that is like, hey, you know who'd be great? I was rewatching My Dinner with Andre the other night, and it's like, Wallace Shawn would be perfect in this comedy bit here.
By the way, I was rewatching My Dinner with Andre the other night is a sentence I've never heard in my entire life.
Because you weren't in the film scene in the 80s when that was like the movie that everybody fucking watched. Like it was for those of you that don't understand in context, My Dinner with Andre is essentially the Clerks of the 80s.
Truth.
Like it is that movie that just exploded on the indie scene and was its own thing. And again, like this could not be duplicated. Like you cannot make another movie about two guys sitting down and having dinner and have it work the way that worked. The same way with you can't shoot a movie in a convenience store in black and white. And
you should never get involved in a land war in Asia.
Asia, yes.
Yeah.
And so that movie had such a connection to the scene and was one of those things that was watched and rewatched in that era in terms of cult indies. And so I have no doubt That's exactly what fucking happened. That Carl Reiner's like, you know what? I was at the Egyptian the other night, and they were showing My Dinner with Andre again, and I've only seen it 17 times now, and so I was watching it again, and I was like, you know who'd be great?
I just imagine Vicini saying things like, well, iocane powder is tasteless and odorless, and also I bought this electric blanket, and it made me feel like, it was like, oh my God, he's going to go on the whole tear about electric blankets again.
That is correct.
That is correct. I think in that scene, like, I just imagine, like, at some point, like, you're going to, and it builds tension very well, because you're like, he breaks it all down, like, I can't choose the cup in front of me, and it's a logic puzzle, and I can't choose the cup in front of you, and this and that and the other thing, and things of this nature. And then they realize, you know, after he's drank the poison, he has that laugh, and then he falls over dead, and Wesley's like, oh, I built up an immunity to iocane powder years ago. So it's like, I won the second I sat down. Which is such great that he fucking engaged him in all that repartee, knowing that no matter what happened, he was still going to win. The only way to win, Vicini, is not to play.
The only winning move is not to play.
If we're going to talk about this movie and how long it's been sort of gestating in Hollywood, to talk about some of the people who were considered for different roles.
Okay.
Because one of the things I thought was really interesting is that Christopher Reeve was originally considered for the role of Wesley.
That would work. That would make sense.
That would absolutely work, especially when you're talking about the fact that, you know, Rob Reiner had this idea while on the set of All in the Family, because William Goldman was apparently a friend of his father's. So while he was working on that, while he was fucking meathead on that show, he was already thinking about making this movie. And then apparently Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was offered the role of Fezzik. And was super excited about it, and it didn't happen. But it's like, yeah, if you think about this movie being made in the mid-70s.
Sorry, Kareem, you're only allowed to be in one classic fucking comedy of all time as a sports star. And
that's Airplane, yeah.
And that's Airplane. You already did that role. Let Andre have it.
And he totally did. Also, apparently, once it got further along in production, Uma Thurman was considered for Buttercup.
Of course she was, because at that point, Uma Thurman was this very hot up-and-coming actress who was really connecting in films and clearly was going to take off.
Well, apparently the reason she didn't get cast is that they thought she was too, quote, exotic looking for the role.
That's not wrong. Like, she had a very peculiar look when she was young. It's what was so attractive about her in her younger days. As she grew older, I don't want to say normalized, but, you know, became more of a traditional beauty, as opposed to there was something delightfully odd about the way she looked as a teenage and very young actress that was played upon in films and was fantastic. But yeah, I could definitely see that saying exotic looking. That's not a euphemism in terms of where you normally hear it. Like,
so
we're looking for an exotic girl. Oh, you mean a minority? And it's right. Like, no. She looked exotic. She looked different.
So this is not Hollywood double talk.
No, this is not Hollywood double talk. That's literally, everyone found her attractive, but could not explain why at the time.
Gotcha.
She was that kind of a beauty.
Apparently, Courtney Cox and Meg Ryan both auditioned for Buttercup.
Doesn't surprise me.
How amazing would it have been if Courtney Cox appeared in both Masters of the Universe and Princess Bride in the same year?
I don't think it would have happened. I think she would have gotten, she wouldn't have been in Masters of the Universe. I think she would have been shooting this. And then that would be one less thing that actually works in Masters of the Universe.
God, now I just imagine Dolph Lundgren as Wesley. Like, instead of Masters of the Universe, those two end up paired up in Princess Bride, and it's...
Yeah, I don't want to see that movie.
No, it's terrible, but I can't stop thinking about it.
Oh,
it's
God.
It's like a car crash I can't look away from, just being like, you wish. No, what? I'm sorry? You have five attempts to get this line right before we fucking dub you, Dolph. That's all I'm going to say. Also, I need to acknowledge the fact that I did, in fact, pull a boner. Because the baseball game he's playing is not Bases Loaded, but Hardball, which was a Commodore 64 game.
Oh my God! I didn't realize you were actually looking that up.
I looked it up because, you know, I'm all about accuracy.
And I used to have that game. That's why I always remembered it. I'm like, oh my God, he's playing this game. And I had it for the Commodore 64. And when you're like, it's for the NES, it's like, oh, it could have been a port. But no, in fact, I want to say the NES was actually just out in 87. We didn't have them yet. It came out in Japan in 86. We got them in 87. Most of us kids couldn't get ours until like 88.
Right. No, absolutely. So it's a little premature to be playing. But I swear to God, I swear, and maybe this is just my faulty memory, I remember there being, maybe I'm thinking of The Wizard. Maybe that's what it is, because it's Fred Savage.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, he's playing video games in a movie. It's a fucking NES.
Because the thing is he's playing with the Atari joystick.
Right.
Because that was the thing, is they actually, the Commodore 64 had the plugs on the side specifically for Atari joysticks. So, like, if you had an Atari and you had a Commodore 64, you just went and pulled the joysticks out of your Atari box, which nobody was playing in 1986 and 87, and you just plugged them into your 64, and then that's how you played.
So, one other thing I wanted to throw out there is that William Goldman said himself that he thought the ideal person to play Buttercup was Carrie Fisher.
Yeah.
Too many princesses for her, though, right? Or am I crazy?
At this point, she was working as a screenwriter, and I don't know that she was acting at this point. And also, at this point in her career, I think she was also way too many drugs. I think this was her heavy drug period. But she would have been fucking fantastic. Like, she would have been great.
Yeah,
as Buttercup.
I agree. I also think that.
But you know what? She did the thing that she. Now that I'm thinking about it, I like Robin Wright Penn a lot better than her in this.
Oh, yeah. Nobody's arguing that should have replaced Robin.
But the thing is that Robin Wright had this innocence about her that Carrie Fisher did not. Carrie Fisher had this, like, this powerful, domineering, I'm in control when I'm in the room kind of thing. That's why Princess Leia is so amazing. Like, Princess Leia, you know, for all the talk that, you know, Princess Leia doesn't have a lot to do in the Star Wars movies, which is true. She stands in a room with Darth Vader and tells him to go fuck himself. She stands in a room with Grand Moff Tarkin, tells him to go fuck himself. Stands in a room with Han Solo, tells him to go fuck himself. There's no, like, fucking, you know, Luke Skywalker walks in and she's like, aren't you a little short to be a stormtrooper? Like, she doesn't take shit from anybody.
And he literally
says,
I'm here to rescue you. Like, the fuck, lady?
She takes shit from nobody. And that's the thing, is I don't see Carrie Fisher's Buttercup dealing with...
She's not a damsel.
Prince Humperdinck.
She's not a damsel.
Yeah, like, being the... Not, like, I don't see Carrie Fisher as a character that I would believe would roll over for Humperdinck, because that's just the way it's got to be right now. Like, it's like, so I think Goldman was kind of wrong on that.
And I mean, and that probably was a byproduct of when they were first considering making the movie. One of the other things I love about this film is that, on the one hand, it's got some of the greatest, like, it is a romance, and it has some of the greatest lines of romantic dialogue of any film you'll ever hear. Like, take any speech delivered from Wesley to Buttercup, Buttercup about Wesley, just copy and paste that into Wedding Vows, and it works every time. That's how fucking good the romantic dialogue is in this film. But at the same time, there are some lines of revenge and action dialogue that it's like fucking Charles Bronson to be like, oh, that's a little much there, bud.
To the pain.
Oh my, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
To the pain is so good. It's to the death. No, to the pain. I'm not familiar with that one. Like, that's,
yeah.
And then that speech he gives, it's just like, shit, that's dark.
Your ears you keep so you can hear every cry of every child that looks at you and says, dear God, what is that thing? It's like, whoa, bringing a sword to a tickle fight.
And then, sure. And then how he finishes off with, draw your sword.
Yeah, and just like fucking backs him down entirely. It's so good. And then, of course, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. Like, whoo. Like,
stop saying that.
I love that. I love that whole, like, and everything about, like, the sort of Dean Martin, Bing Crosby on the road of when when Fezzik and Inigo find Wesley in the albino's hideout, and they're just carrying him along to try and help him get his revenge, and it becomes this whole reversal. Like, oh, it's so good. Like, it's so smartly written. Like, these guys that were enemies like 30 minutes before this are now like in this buddy film to siege the castle.
Yeah, no, they totally make it work. If only we had a Holocaust cloak. Like, just these.
Oh,
these
you mean this little, one?
Oh, yeah, it fits so well that he just said I could keep it. Like, it's all done so very well.
I'm on the Brute Squad. Works.
Yeah.
You are the Brute Squad.
the way these characters, their desires align, and then they just become great friends, and it's exactly what you want from an adventure. Like, what this movie does so well is every single thing in this story isn't a trope, it's a cliche, and he makes the cliche work every fucking time.
Agreed.
Like, it's just the fact that he takes it so meta and allows you to enjoy the cliches is just a masterstroke. It's phenomenal.
And also, I feel like we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the fact that the fantasy elements of this movie and the world building of this story are phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like, creatures like the shrieking eels and the rodents of unusual size.
Oh, God. In fact, that's actually it's not a meme for everyone else, but for me and my wife, whenever we're in a restaurant or on a plane and some baby starts screaming their head off, I always lean over to my wife and I'm like, do you hear that, princess? Those are the shrieking eels.
Oh, that explains our recent flight home from Omaha, actually.
Oh, did I did that. I did that to you, and you gave me the weirdest look. I realized you didn't realize what I was doing.
Well, that is trying to stick your hand down my pants. There's a lot of weird stuff about that.
Very, very weird flight.
It was a very weird flight.
Inconceivable.
Well, that's going to bring us to the junk food pairing,
which you've already talked about—a mutton lettuce and tomato sandwich
with a dessert. With a dessert, of course, of a Reese's peanut butter cup. Because how can you possibly watch this movie and not have a buttercup? So on top of the mutton lettuce and tomato sandwich, when the mutton is nice and lean.
By the way, I guarantee you, you have a nice deli near you. If you live in a larger city, there's a nice deli near you, or a nice, you know, a deli in like a Whole Foods or something like that. Check. They might have roast mutton. We have it here in Austin. You can get nice sliced roast mutton. Roast mutton, for those of you that don't know, is, of course, as I mentioned, lamb. It is a very fragrant, delicious, flavor forward meat. It's imagine like roast beef, but if roast beef were more gamey and more upfront and just like, no, you're tasting me, motherfucker, not the cheese, you're tasting me and the cheese. And it is a mutton lettuce and tomato sandwich is fantastic. Get a nice bread, toast it up real nice, you know,
tomato is nice and crisp.
Yeah, it's it is like, seriously, a mutton lettuce and tomato sandwich is actually a fantastic fucking thing, which is why I think that joke works so well in there, because it really is a really delicious sandwich.
And I want to say this. I feel like Burger King missed a phenomenal opportunity to sponsor this movie, to form a promotional deal with The Princess Bride, because here's where I'm going to nerd out about fast food history. McDonald's was a big deal at the time. Have you ever seen the movie The Founder? By the way, watch that movie. The big deal about McDonald's when they came out was that they were almost Henry Ford like automated. Everything just came out of the assembly line. 1, 2, 3, you got your food immediately. But what that meant was, if you ever wanted to change anything about your order, it gummed up the works. They were really fucking like, oh, we don't know how to handle that. So when Burger King came out, one of their big fuck you to McDonald's was,
have it your way,
have it as you wish. Why in the fucking hell did they not do a promotional deal with The Princess Bride?
I don't think anybody knew. Like, this was an October film after a cluttered fucking summer. Like, wrap your head around this. We are doing a movie on the notable films of a summer, on the notable films of 87, and we can't do them all. Like, true we story. Have to skip. Like, people are like, why are you skipping this? Why are you skipping that? And it's like, because really, this was one of those summers that, unlike others, like, if we were to do one on the summer we just had, notable films, we'd do a month and a half. half like of notable films. This was a particular summer that was so jam-packed that this was a movie that didn't fit in it.
Yeah.
And was an October release.
This
because I don't think anybody believed this was going to become what it became.
Princess Bride is coming off the bench for our 87 series. Like, that's how good this year, this summer was. So, yeah, no, for sure. So, I want to play a little game of Price is Right before we go out, Cargill. Of the most iconic lines in this movie, As You Wish, Inconceivable, My Name is Inigo Montoya, which one do you think is said the most in the film?
Inconceivable. No. Said the most? My Name is Inigo Montoya. Like, in that final scene alone, it's got to be, like, what, 17 times?
It's actually As You Wish.
Really?
As You Wish is said 7 times, Inconceivable 5 times, Inigo Montoya 6 times. So, As You Wish, actually, and that, but that's what's crazy is there's so many quotable lines in this film that are repeated in very key moments that it's hard to know which one is actually said the most. And as it turns out, it's
As You Wish.
As You Wish. Guys, thank you so much for joining us on this episode. If you would like to, if you wish to hear more of us, you can always follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. You can also become a patron at patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. We're going to be doing a number of Summer of 77 episodes to kind of catch up. We just posted one on The Spy Who Loved Me. We're going to be doing top fives. We're going to be doing more a la modes. We're going to be talking about our trip to Omaha and the Draft House Marathon that we hosted out there. There's a lot of great stuff to be had in the Patreon exclusive content area of Patreon. So again, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. If you want to find me specifically on the social media interwebs, you can go to @BryGuySalisbury on the Twitters and, of course, Brian Salisbury Critic on Facebook. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter at Massaworm, MassaWyrm, and on Instagram at Massaworm.
Awesome. Yeah, okay, so that's going to do it for this show, but I want to remind you before we go out that never, ever, ever disparage the good name of Skatetown USA. That's a rule known by everyone. The second and only slightly less well-known rule is never get involved in a land war in Asia and never go up against Junk Food Cinema when Swayze is on the line.